I'm Devin Stewart here at Carnegie Council in New York City, and today I'm speaking with Daniel Markey. He's a senior research professor at SAIS Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he's also a former U.S. State Department official focusing on South Asia from 2003 to 2007. Dan, great to talk with you today.
Happy to join you.
So Dan, knowing what we know about the Trump administration, which is not a whole lot, but we have some pieces of the puzzle to look at. How do you see the emerging Trump administration foreign policy approach? How are you making sense of it? What can you tell us?
Well, you know, like a lot of people in Washington, I'm actually having an unusually difficult time making sense of the Trump team's policy message, in part because pieces of it seem to be well, at least not complementary, and in some cases, apparently contradictory. But I guess where a lot of it begins is with this notion of, in his words, make America great again. So there's a lot of inward-facing policy, and some of that translates into the idea of shoring up America's borders, providing a sense of greater security, which would suggest a focus on counterterrorism and a harder edge there. His comments about America's allies and the need for them to pay their fair share also raises some questions about traditional alliances. And then the last big point would be simply that his views of relations with other big countries like Russia and China are, at least so far, somewhat out of the mainstream, and especially Russia. But he's already picked a couple of fights with China, and so these are warning signs, at least from my perspective.
Do you see certain personalities being more influential than others in the foreign policy team?
Well, even that is difficult to say. Through the campaign, Mike Flynn, who will be the new, or is, I guess, the new National Security Advisor, seemed to have then-candidate Trump's ear on a lot of foreign policy issues, particularly this question of countering terrorists, as they would say, Islamic fundamentalists or extremists, terrorists, and so on. But it's not clear now that you're getting cabinet positions filled out that Flynn will necessarily carry the same weight as someone like General Mattis, the new Secretary of Defense, or even somebody like Rex Tillerson over at State. I think when they're in the room and it's a cabinet-level meeting, some of these other characters may have simply more to say, more experience, and their positions may be taken more seriously even than Flynn's would. And then there are a lot of wild cards here, too. You've got the kind of the kitchen cabinet folks, the Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon and others, who hard to tell what role they'll have on the foreign policy front.
Now, if you look at the people who do seem to have Trump's ear on foreign policy, is there any kind of common worldview that they share, or is it all over the place?
Honestly, it looks pretty all over the place to me. There, you can try to... Well, let me stick with the all over the place first. You know, I'm one who is reluctant to try to put too much coherence into interpreting something that may actually just be incoherent. And everything about the process, the vetting process for selecting national security officials, Trump's own seeming ignorance on a lot of quite significant foreign policy issues, all of that suggests that, in fact, it shouldn't be at all surprising that there's incoherence and inconsistency among his senior appointees, which came out in their confirmation hearings. So I tend to stick with that. But if you press and you say, you know, you have to find a thread of consistency, it would probably come back to a kind of a very seemingly nationalistic, one might say realist, that is power-centered perspective on the world, one much less concerned about multilateralism, even about traditional alliances, and certainly one in which issues relating to human rights or promotion of democracy figure practically not at all.
Is there a moral value that will take the place of traditional liberalism, or do you think it's just going to be mostly transactional?
Well, to the extent that there will be at least a rhetorical flourish having to do with more morally oriented or ethically oriented issues, it will be a nod toward a sense of patriotism. Would be the nicest possible way to put it, a sense that American foreign policy is there to advance U.S. interests, to help the people of the United States, and the sense that seeking stability and security on the global stage to advance those interests has value because it is the U.S., in fact, that he is the president of, can be seen as having a certain normative quality to it. But it's pretty far from some of the soaring rhetoric that we certainly heard in different ways from other American presidents over the years.
Now, looking at your specialty on U.S. foreign policy toward Asia, are there things that are coming together where we could expect certain policy gestures toward Asia, South Asia and East Asia, or are you still waiting to see what's going to happen?
Well, coming back to this notion of traditional alliances, when you look at East Asia, you think about the relations between the United States and countries like Japan, where we've had a close relationship spanning many decades, or even South Korea. I think there are a number of big question marks. Alliances are never easy to manage, and Trump has shown, as a candidate, less appreciation for the value of those relationships, often that goes beyond the kind of the dollars and cents in every passing year. And it's only in a recognition of the kind of the longer-term value of these relationships, as well as the extent to which U.S. effort has been put into these relationships going over decades, that you begin to kind of take a wider view. So that's worrisome, and I think something that we should follow closely. But probably more important, so far at least, would be questions relating to China. I was in Beijing, about a month ago, and there was a tremendous concern among Chinese scholars as well as policymakers, policy-oriented analysts, about what Trump would mean for their relationship. And a lot of his talk about trade with the Chinese, his sense that the Chinese aren't playing by fair rules, a lot of that is quite appealing to the American public, but it doesn't necessarily suggest a very clear policy toward China, exactly how he's going to remedy that. And then more worrisome than that were some of the interaction over Taiwan, where clearly the Chinese were quite concerned over what that would mean, and where I think as Americans we need to recognize that certain things like Taiwan are taken incredibly seriously by Beijing, and picking a fight over those issues could relatively quickly spiral out of control into territory that the new Trump administration won't be ready for. So just beginning there, I'd say those are some top issues. I guess the one other one would be North Korea. By a number of reports, there are greater concerns about what North Korea is doing in the way of developing its missile technologies in ways that could pose big decision points for the new Trump administration earlier rather than later.
That's a lot to think about. And before we get to South Asia specifically, looking at Asia as a whole, what are the most dangerous events that could happen in the region that could spark a major foreign policy crisis for the Trump administration, do you think?
Well, if you'd asked me that a year ago and it wasn't necessarily the Trump administration, I don't think Taiwan would have been on the list. My impression was that the China-Taiwan situation was relatively constant, that neither side was itching to cause trouble. And yet we've already seen, in terms of at least at a diplomatic level, we've seen a spat brewing over Taiwan. That's always been, at least for decades now, that's been an area of, always pointed to as one of the top places where you could get a direct U.S.-China conflict. And of course, South China and East China Seas always seem to be one or two steps away from some potential escalation, so you can't overlook those. I already mentioned North Korea. As somebody who focuses on South Asia, India, Pakistan is not, the relationship between those two countries is not as bad as it has been at other points in history, but it's not at all good. There's no particular desire either in New Delhi or Islamabad to pursue a more kind of peaceful approach with each other. Both sides are irritated and frustrated, so it's conceivable that something could start to escalate there, and of course that's a potentially nuclear escalation. Those would be some of the ones that I'd put near the top of my list.
That's certainly a lot. Would you say that Asia is going to produce the first crisis for the administration?
You know, unfortunately, right now it doesn't have to be, unless you consider parts of the Middle East as Asia. But typically, we try to separate those out. There's just as much chance that you could get, that the administration can be quite focused on Syria, on ISIS, on Iraq, on questions of how to make good on certain promises that candidate Trump made about crushing ISIS and solving those kinds of problems. And then there are big looming questions, even just in Afghanistan, which has gotten almost no attention throughout most of the campaign cycle, about what the new U.S. military and every other part of its strategy will be there. So there are lots of things that pull even in those directions. And even in Europe, you've got, relating to Russia as well as to the problem of the flow of migrants out of North Africa and the Middle East. You've got big troubles brewing there. And that's before you get into more of the political economy of it all with Brexit and so on. So, yeah, there are tons of things that could go wrong in Asia, but it's hard to tell where the administration will be pulled first. And in its own statements, as much as it's possible to discern a worldview, the issues that have come up more than Asia per se would be terrorism. So if the administration has its choice, it would probably take action there sooner rather than later.
And then looking at terrorism, the fight against ISIS and Pakistan's cooperation with the United States, you've written that the United States could benefit under a Trump administration if Trump is seen as a madman, like how President Nixon was described in terms of dealing with Vietnam. Tell us, how would that work?
Well, this piece that you're referring to is my effort to grapple with a problem that we've been dealing with Pakistan, certainly since 9/11. And the core of the problem is that Pakistan, while somewhat helpful at times, hasn't been nearly as helpful and certainly not consistently helpful in fighting terrorists on its own soil during that entire period. And of course, everybody is familiar with the reality that we found Osama bin Laden based inside of Pakistan, and he had been there for years. But there's a broader problem here, which is that Pakistan doesn't necessarily see all of the militant extremist groups that are based on its soil as terrorists in the same way that we do. And that's really got to change if there's any way to bring the U.S. and Pakistan into a long and effective partnership. But it hasn't changed. And so the question I wanted to ask was, well, suppose if you could come up with a way to much more effectively coerce or threaten Pakistan, could you begin to see them change gears? And the logic behind that is that right after 9/11, the president of Pakistan did shift gears significantly, did help us at least temporarily in going after top al-Qaeda leaders that were based inside Pakistan. There was a policy shift on their part, and that was in part, I think, I'm convinced, because then President Musharraf of Pakistan was quite scared of what the then Bush administration might do if they didn't do what the United States asked. So if you get a Trump that was somehow able to be much more effective in his coercive threats, maybe Pakistan would shift gears and actually take the United States more seriously. The problem, and what I tried to point out in the piece, is even if he played the madman, that is, even if he seemed like he was willing to do just about anything to get Pakistan to play by our rules, it would still be really difficult to push the Pakistanis into actually compliance on all of these issues. And so I try to point out how the Pakistanis might behave, as well as how difficult that would be to counter, and how necessary it would be for the Trump administration, the Trump team, to be really unified and really capable and steadfast and kind of ruthless in its application of coercion, all of which, given what we've seen so far, the messiness of this new team, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of indiscipline, it's hard to imagine that actually working. So I concluded the piece basically on a kind of a sour note of, be careful, because a real madman could make things a lot worse with Pakistan. And ultimately, that's where I come down. I'm actually more worried about the trouble that could ensue from an attempted coercive approach, and also from a foreign policy that seems, undisciplined, not connected to a clear stance, not consistent. Other countries, including Pakistan, will see through that.
And the implied threat would be what specifically?
Well, basically, you could part of the challenge would be what would it take? What kind of a threat would you need to have in order to push a big country like Pakistan, a nuclear armed country like Pakistan, into changing its behavior not using proxies against inside of Afghanistan, not supporting any terrorists on its soil. And so you'd probably want to not be too specific in some ways, because the more specific you are, the more they begin to kind of do a cost-benefit analysis. But you would want to guarantee that they would suffer a serious consequence that would include probably some military action, definitely sanctions and other economic efforts to kind of bring their already not particularly fast-growing economy to a standstill, and you would want to be able to try to show that you would target individuals and groups inside of Pakistan directly who you think were doing the wrong thing. If you could put all those pieces together, plus advance the U.S.-India relationship, one that Pakistan's already quite nervous about, and perhaps suggest a greater resolve inside of Afghanistan, you might be able to begin to tip the scales.
When you say that the madman approach could actually make things worse, I'm thinking about the many times that Donald Trump has mentioned a kind of pride in being unpredictable in international affairs as an asset to getting better deals.
Mm-hmm.
What is the exact risk that type of approach carries in terms of being unpredictable and seen as a madman? How could things get worse?
Well, from my perspective, the biggest problem with being a madman, for truly being unpredictable in negotiations, is not so much with your adversaries, it's with your allies. And the United States is lucky and has worked hard to build up alliance relationships around the world. And it's one of the things that differentiates the United States from anybody else out there. I mean, we talk about a rising China. We talk about a troublesome Russia. No other country in the world has built up a network of both partnerships and friendships and good working relationships and true binding alliances as the United States. And in an alliance, a lot of it is founded on the notion of a commitment and a sense on both sides that they will live up to what they have promised one another. And if you don't have that, it begins to break down. And so that's where an unpredictability is the greatest liability and where I really see Trump as being a problem. When you start to talk about unpredictability and dealing with adversaries, then it's a more of a mixed story. It's not entirely clear. Sometimes it might actually be useful to be able to bluff. It might be able to useful to get some adversary to think that you're going to do something that you might not actually do, but they have no way of knowing otherwise. But even there, well, I think it's important to recognize, and unfortunately, you can even see this in the life story of our new president. This is a game that is foreign policy and America's relationship in the world. It's a game that gets repeated again and again and again. And mistakes that are made have long-lasting consequences, definitely spanning decades. People remember. People in other countries, including countries that I work on, like Pakistan and India, remember what they believe to have been missteps by the United States. It becomes a part of their collective understanding of history. And, you know, Trump has a very short memory, even apparently of his own actions in the business community. He's burned a lot of people. That doesn't seem to bother him at all. He just goes about his business. Well, if the United States behaves that way, it'll be that much harder to find goodwill anywhere in years to come. And so that's, again, and or to find trust or to find even that you can bluff your way through with adversaries will become more difficult over time. So, you know, the good credit of the United States is something that he can quickly squander, but it comes at a cost.
Absolutely. I'd like to end with a discussion on U.S.-India relations. Two big democratic, populist, and now populist countries.
Yes.
Are Modi and Trump, are they sort of cut from the same cloth? And, you know, there's been some comparisons of the two. What do you think of that? And also, do you see them as sort of natural allies?
It's a great question. And it's one where I feel like sometimes the similarities between India and the United States that jump out on paper, that is, as you put it, you know, two big democracies, two popular, or at least reasonably popular, and definitely populist leaders, two outsiders, you know, for those less familiar with Prime Minister Modi. He hadn't spent any time really in New Delhi prior to becoming prime minister. He basically took over his party and edged out older established politicians, and it is now the party of Modi, which it hadn't really been so much before. And so there are a number of similarities on paper. The challenge is, you know, the United States and India are in such different places. In terms of their levels of development, the political struggles that they face, what the needs of their peoples actually are, and some of the cleavages within society, in terms of in India, communal differences, vastly different, you know, in terms of diversity that makes the United States look all very similar in comparison. I mean, many different languages, many, many different religions, and so on across India. And it's just that much more vast as a country. So it's hard to, and the political cultures are also quite different. So I'm reluctant to draw too much in the way of comparison between the two, but at least on paper, there are some interesting similarities. And then the second part of the question being sort of, is it a naturally positive relationship? It could well be. I do think that as politicians, as populists, as people who like to use Twitter, both of them will—they will have things in common. And as people who are eager to focus on doing business and building up economic opportunities for their countries in a variety of creative ways, I think there'll be a convergence of interest there. Both of them talk a lot about things like infrastructure, although India and the United States, again, in totally different places on that issue. But yeah, I think there are some natural policy convergences and diplomatic convergences there, too. One other area would be having to do with the fight against against terrorism, and India would very much like the United States to take an expansive view on the threat posed by Islamic terrorism, because India faces what it considers to be Islamic terrorism as well, And the United States hasn't always lumped those threats in the same place as Al-Qaeda or ISIS. India would like to have the United States be very clear that it's on the same side in that fight, even if there may be distinctions on precisely which groups they see as threatening. So, so those are all policy convergences. One big potential gap between them is that Modi would like to build up manufacturing in India, and he would like to create all kinds of new, more highly paying jobs in India. And Trump says he wants to do the same thing in the United States. So on questions of, for instance, hot items that India cares about, like getting more visas for talented Indians to come to the United States and work here and form ventures, joint ventures between India and the United States, that's going to run headlong into some of the rhetoric, at least, that Trump has used during the campaign about shutting our borders and keeping jobs at home and building up our manufacturing here. So there's at least some potential for a divergence on those issues.
Very interesting, Dan. That's it's gonna get very complicated as most administrations can start out with a fairly clear goal and then things get complicated. The world happens.
They sure do.
Final question, and this has been a great conversation with you today, is for people listening to this podcast and reading the transcript. If we want to try to get a sense of understanding the Trump approach toward Asia going forward, what things should we be looking at specifically? I know there's been some speculation about a hole in the administration in terms of senior officials in the agencies, filling those positions, getting the new team on board and up to speed, or is it more sort of top-level diplomacy, or should we be looking at the various crises that might happen in the region itself? In the next few weeks or so, what would you advise people to look closely at?
Well, I'd have to say, sitting here in the sort of inside the Beltway Washington world, most of us are probably more fixated on who's getting what job, who's going to own what portfolio. And there's at least some hope that on a variety of issues, the different departments, that is the State Department, the Defense Department, and so on, and will own a great deal more of that policy than may even have been the case in the Obama administration. In short, that the White House may not drive quite as much of foreign policy, that may run a fairly lean operation and leave a lot of the nuts and bolts, and in fact, most of the operational aspects to the cabinet-level officials who, when you talk about Tillerson or you talk about Mattis, are at least somewhat more familiar, in Mattis's case, a great deal more familiar with the functioning of those departments. And so then it really matters, who's working on these issues, who's beneath them, who's going to take charge, who's going to manage things. The White House probably just simply doesn't have the familiarity, the experience, maybe not even the instinct as to how to grapple with these challenges right out of the gate, much less manage how they all fit together in a more sophisticated or complicated way. So appointments matter a lot. And then the only really kind of big caveat to that is, but things could really go haywire before everybody gets into place. And then we're going to be watching what happens on the ground and just how it's managed. This is always, the first few months of an administration are always a messy time. A lot of policy issues just get put on the back burner. And everybody just in the bureaucracy just kind of tees them up and waits around until enough of the appointees are in place to actually make decisions, get things going. And that can take 3 to 6 to 9 months. And in some cases, rare cases, even longer. So that's always true. But I think this one looks like it's going to take even longer. And even when it happens, it may be a less cohesive, more decentralized approach to policy than in the past, which, if you're sitting at the State Department, may be a kind of a relief. You say, you have more power and control to implement, more authority to do what you think is right, less White House meddling than we've seen in the past. So we'll see how that plays out. But yes, appointees are probably the thing to look at.
Well, that's a pretty relatively hopeful note to end on. And
okay.
Dan, it's been great speaking with you. Daniel Markey, he's a senior research professor at Johns Hopkins SAIS in Washington, D.C. Very great speaking with you today, Dan. Thank you.
Great talking with you, too.